Hi, everyone. This is Carrie, and I'm continuing on with a podcast that covers the hemodynamic monitoring and circulatory devices PowerPoint. The first podcast talked about the definitions and arterial line system. This podcast is going to cover more of the pulmonary artery pressure monitoring. So we're going to start with the one that monitors the pulmonary artery and the pressures more within the pulmonary system. So we're going to start with a slide that talks about the pulmonary artery pressure monitoring. That's the title of the slide. So this pulmonary artery pressure monitoring guides the acute phase management of patients with select complicated heart and lung problems. So we have pulmonary artery diastolic, which stands for PAD pressure, as well as a pulmonary artery wedge pressure, which is abbreviated as PAWP, and they're sensitive indicators of cardiac function as well as fluid status. So that's an important thing to remember. They monitor the cardiac function, but a big indicator of fluid status. These increase, so these numbers are going to be high when a patient is in heart failure and fluid volume overload. So again, think about where the fluid goes if it's backing up. If the heart is not pumping it out, where is it backing up to? From the left ventricle to the left atrium to the lungs. And where the volumes go is, again, in the pulmonary artery around that area of the lungs is where they're going to have increased pressure. So that's going to be important. So when we know that medication is effective, these pressures are going to actually go down. So they'll decrease with volume depletion. Fluid therapy based on your pulmonary artery pressure can restore fluid balance while avoiding overcorrection and undercorrection of the problem. So this is a really intricate way of balancing someone's fluid volume. Again, only done in an ICU, but it can be done very cautiously without causing other complications because we can monitor it so closely. So this allows precise therapeutic manipulation of preload. This allows our cardiac output to be maintained without placing the patient at risk for pulmonary edema. So these measurements are very important in someone who is really sick. So the next slide talks about the Swan-Ganz catheter, our pulmonary artery flow-directed catheter. Again, people will just talk about the Swan-Ganz catheter, and that basically means it's in the pulmonary artery. So it measures our pressures in our pulmonary artery as well as our pulmonary artery wedge pressure. There's one catheter they lace through that can do multiple things. And the next slide will show a picture of that device. When properly positioned, the distal lumen is within the pulmonary artery itself. This port is used to monitor our pulmonary artery pressures and sample mixed venous blood specimens. Again, therefore, we can look at our actual O2 sat of that blood and it'll give us a very accurate measurement. A balloon is also connected to an external valve surrounding the distal lumen port, and you can kind of see that in that picture. The balloon has two purposes. One, to allow moving blood to float the catheter forward once it's in the heart, so it's used for placement. And number two, allow for the pulmonary artery wedge pressure measurement once we actually get it where we want it within the pulmonary artery. There are also two proximal lumens with exit ports in the right atrium or right atrium and right ventricle if there's two. The right atrium port is used for measurement of central venous pressure, CVP, injection of fluid for cardiac output determination, and withdrawal of a blood specimen. If there is a second proximal port, it is used for infusion of fluids, drugs, or blood sampling. There's also a temperature sensor known as a thermistor located near the distal tip and is wired to an external connector. This is used to monitor blood or core temperature and for thermal dilution using method of measuring cardiac output. And we're not going to talk about what those are, but we did mention in class that we're doing a lot with hypothermia and bringing the core temperature up slowly. If indicated, if they do have this line placed, this is the most accurate way to measure that core temperature. It can be done rectally, and that's how it would be done if they didn't have a pulmonary artery catheter placed. But if they have this placed, this is how they're going to be doing that measurement. Again, you can kind of see the picture on the next slide of what a pulmonary catheter it looks like. On the next slide, it talks about pulmonary artery pressure monitoring, some specialized features. I'm not going to go into these. So in addition to the features we just talked about, There are these features available. And just so you know, it can do other things. That's what you need to get off that slide. I want to talk a little bit about pre and post procedure, what we need to think about. So before they actually put in a pulmonary artery catheter, we need to look at their electrolyte balance, acid base, their oxygenation, and coag studies. So how is the coagulation ability of their blood? Imbalances such as hypokalemia, hypomagnesia, hypoxemia, or acidosis can make the heart more irritable and increase the risk of ventricular dysrhythmias during that catheter insertion. Coagulopathy also increases the risk of hemorrhage, so we just have to make sure the patient can tolerate the procedure. So as I'm talking through this next, how it goes through, actually, if you want to look at the picture of the on the next slide, you can actually see it floating through the heart as I'm kind of talking through how it goes, so you can get a picture of your mind of how this inserted. So first, before we actually put it in, we need to prepare the patient for the procedure, which includes arranging the monitor, cables, and infusion and pressurizing flush solutions. The system is zeroed, again, just like before, related to that phlebostatic access. The physician or other healthcare provider is going to explain the procedure to the patient, and then we need informed consent because it is invasive. We put the patient on supine, position supine and flat. The PA catheter is inserted through a sheath percutaneously into the intrajugular, subclavian, antecubital, or femoral vein using surgical sepsis, and the physician will decide which vein they would like to cannulate. We rarely do a venous cut down, meaning they actually dig down deep to find an internal one just because of the risk of infection related to that. So they will get whatever one they can reach easiest from the skin. We need to continuously observe the characteristic waveform on the monitor as the catheter is moved through the heart. And you can see that now on the next slide. When the tip reaches the right atrium, the balloon is inflated. Inflation of this balloon should not exceed the balloon's capacity, which is only 1 to 1.5 mL of air. The catheter is then floated, it kind of flows along with the blood flow, through the tricuspid valve and into the right ventricle, and then through the pulmonic valve to the pulmonary artery. We need to monitor the ECG continuously during insertion because of the risk of dysrhythmias, particularly when the catheter reaches the right ventricle, because it has to kind of make a curve and go up. That's why they float it with the blood to cause the least amount of irritation to the heart, which could cause a dysrhythmia. Once the typical pulmonary artery wedge pressure tracing is observed, the balloon is deflated. So once it gets to the pulmonary artery, it kind of occludes that artery, and that will give them the tracing for the pulmonary artery wedge pressure. Then they deflate the balloon. The PA waveform should return on the monitor. Following insertion and before using the pulmonary artery catheter, we need to take a chest x-ray to verify the position of the catheter. So to maintain its proper position, it's secured at the point of entry to the skin. Again, note and record the measurement at the exit point. Finally, apply an occlusive dressing, and then change that dressing according to policy per sterile technique. Recently, in the news and some of the research I've read, the use of the PA pressure monitoring is decreased dramatically. This is due in part due to risks associated with the technology, which is high risk for infection. And if we get an infection in a line that goes directly to our heart, people can get sick and die quite quickly. So, because of this risk and the development of less invasive techniques, they're not doing this as much. The APCO monitor I briefly mentioned before is one of those technologies that's newer that we're starting to see used more and more. So I'm not sure what you're going to see when you get to your ICU, but look and see what type of monitor they have. And if you have questions about it, please ask. That's the best way to learn. All right, the next then slide after the picture talks about our case study. So let's refer to that. After insertion of the pulmonary artery line, the healthcare provider orders a pulmonary artery wedge pressure and cardiac output measurement every 4 hours. So how are we going to obtain the measurement? And so the next slide actually talks about how they actually obtain the measurement and where it actually goes. And I don't necessarily need you to understand that. I'm not going to ask you questions as to how you would obtain the measurement. You just know that we cannot inflate that balloon. We get the reading when that balloon is inflated. And we don't want to inflate that for more than 8 to 15 seconds because remember, we're occluding blood flow to that pulmonary artery and we don't want further complications. So we truly, if we're the one running that monitoring, we need to make sure that we're following the guidelines so we don't cause further injury. So the next few slides actually show the pulmonary artery itself and what the pulmonary artery wedge pressure would look like. Again, I'm not going to necessarily ask you specific questions about, you know, wedged balloon or what that looks like or, you know, these different interpreting these waveforms. So just go ahead. You can just kind of review those if you are interested. And if you're thinking this is already too much information, just feel free to skip that. That's just fine. So, but we do need to hit heavy on or talk a lot about central venous pressure monitoring or CVP. CVP is a measurement of the right ventricle preload and reflects fluid volume problems. Okay, so remember, central venous pressure again is related to fluid and fluid volume. It is the most often measured with central venous catheter placed in the internal jugular or subclavian vein. It can be measured with the pulmonary artery catheter using the proximal lumen located in the right atrium as well. So a CVP waveform, I have a picture of that on the next slide, is similar to the pulmonary artery wedge pressure waveform. It measures as a mean pressure at the end of expiration. So an elevated CVP indicates right ventricular failure or volume overload. So let me say that again, because it's most important to understand what they're measuring. So an elevated CVP indicates right ventricular failure or a volume overload. A low central venous pressure indicates low volume or hypovolemia. Okay? So that's very important to remember. The next slide actually talks about the waveforms related to the heart and what we're actually seeing with the EKG. Again, just kind of information for you there. Measuring cardiac output or continuous cardiac output, we can actually do that with the pulmonary artery catheter. The PA catheter with thermal filament located in the right atrium, it senses changes in the temperature of the blood as it passes through the right ventricle. So, and actually based on that and the temperature, they can calculate the cardiac output. Isn't technology quite amazing? The continuous cardiac output method eliminates the need for fluid boluses. It reduces the risk of contamination and permits ongoing evaluation or trending of the cardiac output. So you may or may not see continuous cardiac output depending on the patient. Again, it can be obtained from the pulmonary artery catheter. Back at our case, AJ's pulmonary catheter does not have the capability to obtain these measurements. So how will you perform an intermittent bolus thermodilution cardiac assessment for AJ? That's a really great question, but I have decided not necessarily to include that because I'm not going to ask you any questions on the thermodilution. I think you need to be working in the ICU that uses that frequently in order to need to understand that. So we're not going to talk about this thermodilution at all. So we're actually going to skip the next few slides that talks about that, and we're going to go to the slide starting with systemic vascular resistance. All right, it's measuring cardiac output. And it talks about SVR, SVRI, SVSVI, okay? And let's talk about what those mean. So SVR stands for systemic vascular resistance. SVRI is systemic vascular resistance index. SV stands for stroke volume. And SVI, stroke volume index, can be calculated each time that we measure cardiac output. So again, these are just information pieces for you. So you understand what these terms mean, okay? Increase in stroke volume or systemic vascular resistance indicates vasoconstriction. So if we break those terms apart, systemic vascular resistance, what does that mean? Systemic are vessels that lead to the rest of our body. Vascular are vessels. Resistance, tightening. So hopefully, even by just pulling that term apart, you know what's going on in the body. So if all these abbreviations are getting you nervous or confused, take a breath. And just start to pull the words apart, and you should be able to then think through what's going on with your patient. or what's going on with the measurement even. So to say that again, an increase in systemic vascular resistance indicates vasoconstriction. And this can be from shock, hypertension, increased release or administration of epinephrine, or other vasoactive agents could also indicate left ventricular failure. A low systemic vascular resistance then indicates the opposite, which is vasodilation, which may occur in shock states. We just talked about shock. That should make sense to us. Or with drugs that affect our afterload. So in clinical practice, changes in our stroke volume are becoming more important indicators of our pumping status of the heart than any other parameter. A high stroke volume is seen with bradycardia and exercise and with the use of positive ionotropes. An example of that medication is dopamine. Low stroke volume is seen with tachydysrhythmias, extreme vasodilation, and cardiac tamponade. So if you think through those things, hopefully they'll make sense to you. We've talked about our O2 sat and our SaO2, our PaO2, to some extent, but we also can measure our venous oxygen sat. And that abbreviation is our SCVO2. And this measurement determines the adequacy of our tissue oxygenation. And so they will actually compare that, the PaO2 to the SVO2, and to see how well the body is actually releasing the oxygen to the tissues, how much is coming back. And so this is a new measurement, recently new, that we're actually using to see how well the body is taking up the oxygen that it is needing. And that's basically kind of in a nutshell what it can tell you. So on the next slide, it talks about the SVO2 and SCVO2 reflects the balance between oxygenation of arterial blood, tissue perfusion, and tissue oxygen consumption. It's useful in assessing hemodynamic status in response to treatment or activities when considered in conjunction with our arterial O2 sat. So you really need to know, one, the PaO2, the O2 sat, in order to tell if our SVO2, you know, if that, the significance of that value. A normal SVO2 at rest is 60 to 80. So we want to just then look at what's going on, if it's higher or lower than that. So when we have a low SVO2, it can indicate a decreased arterial oxygenation, low cardiac output, low hemoglobin levels, or an increased O2 consumption or extraction. So when we don't have enough oxygen coming back on the hemoglobin, why? Okay, if it's decreased. So maybe there's not enough oxygen to begin with. Maybe the heart isn't pumping enough blood. Maybe there's not enough hemoglobin to carry the oxygen. That would be another one. Or the body is using up more, the demand is higher in the body, and so not as much as coming back. If this level falls below 60%, we need to figure out the cause. So we need to observe for changes in our arterial oxygenation. Again, we would get that from our PaO2, SaO2, drawn from our ABGs, and indirectly assess our cardiac output and our tissue perfusion. This is done by noting any changes in mental status, strength and quality of peripheral pulses, capillary refill, urine output, skin color, and temperature. If arterial oxygenation, cardiac output, and hemoglobin are unchanged, a fall in this indicates an increased oxygen consumption or extraction. This could represent an increased metabolic rate, pain, movement, or fever. So if we can't rule out any other way of why too much is being used, then the metabolic rate of the body is increased. So we're using up more oxygen than we normally would, and we have to figure out that cause. If O2 consumption increases without a comparable increase in our O2 delivery, more O2 is extracted from the blood, and the SVO2 will continue to fall. So basically, we need to just ask ourselves that question, why are we using up more oxygen than is expected, than our tissues normally need? Solve the problem. We're hitting that point now with critical care. Everything is a puzzle, and we have to put the pieces together in order to make it fit. So let's think about the flip side of that. We have venous oxygen saturation that is high, our SVO2 that high. So an increase could basically be clinically significant as well, so they could be getting better. So we have an increase in arterial oxygen, O2 sat, improved perfusion, decreased metabolic rate, the sepsis is going away, all of those things we need to think about. In sepsis, though, oxygen is not extracted properly at the tissue level, resulting in an increase, can also actually increase your SVO2. So sepsis can be a confusing thing, but you will just have to look at that. So what is causing the tissues to not use as much oxygen? So we just need to think about that. Why? So the biggest thing is if they're not using oxygen, they've gone to anaerobic metabolism, they could be getting worse if it's sepsis, or they could be getting better. So we have to look at not just this one value to put that piece together. We have to look at the blood work. We have to look at the other readings. We have to look at their fluid volume status. There's so many pieces to this puzzle that this is just one of those things that we need to understand. Our case study, what nursing interventions will you plan to prevent complications related to the pulmonary artery catheter? And the next slide talks about how to prevent some of those complications. So infections and sepsis, these are serious problems associated with pulmonary artery catheters. So careful surgical sepsis for insertion is and maintenance of the catheter and attached tubing is essential to prevent infection. Clean the skin according to the agency policy, usually with a chlorhexidine preparation. That's that clear stuff we use almost all the time anymore with starting IVs. Cover the insertion site with a sterile occlusive dressing. Monitor the patient for local and systemic signs of infection. And you know what those are. So make sure we're looking at the patient closely. To reduce the risk of infection, change the flush bag, pressure tubing, transducer, and stopcock every 96 hours or according to the policy of the where you're at, the facility policy. Aneurysm embolism is another risk associated with a pulmonary artery catheter, and that can happen again. Remember, there's a balloon in there that we use to get the pulmonary artery wedge pressure. So we have to look at the integrity of that balloon before insertion and look and when we discard it, if there is any defects in the catheter itself or the balloon. After insertion, balloon rupture or injection of air into the lumen, including the lumen of a ruptured balloon, can cause an air embolus, and people have died from this. So it is a serious complication. So to decrease the risk of an air embolism, we first need to aspirate to check for the absence or presence of blood, and by injecting only the prescribed volume of air into the balloon before obtaining the pulmonary artery wedge pressure. If we aspirate blood from the balloon port, or see that injection air does not passively flow back into the syringe, we need to label that catheter do not use and notify the physician. Air can also be introduced into the system if the connections are not tight. So therefore, again, always use a lure lock connection on all pressure lines. In addition, set the low pressure alarm for all pressure lines to signal any drop in pressure at all to indicate a leak or loose connection. Complications with a pulmonary artery catheter continued on here. We can actually have a patient that can have a pulmonary infarction or a pulmonary artery rupture itself. So there are four main causes to think about. The first one can be the balloon may rupture, releasing air and fragments that could embolize. Two, if we left that balloon inflated for too long, that could obstruct the blood flow. Three, the catheter can advance into a wedge position, obstructing blood flow. Or four, a thrombus could form and embolize along the tube itself, the catheter itself. So to reduce these risks, never inflate the balloon beyond the balloon's capacity. Monitor your pulmonary artery pressure waveforms continuously for evidence of catheter occlusion, dislocation, or spontaneous wedging, so the occluding of the vessel. Pressure tracings will be blunted if the catheter starts to be occluded, and you'll be able to pick that up. To reduce the risk of thrombus and embolus formation, the PA catheter is continuously flushed. We talked about that in the setup with a slow infusion of normal saline. Again, very similar to an ART line to prevent thrombus formation. We also need to advocate for the removal of the pulmonary artery catheter once our hemodynamic monitoring is no longer needed. So be the patient's voice here and get that out as soon as possible. Ventricular dysrhythmias can occur during pulmonary artery catheter insertion or removal, or if the tip moves from the pulmonary artery to the right ventricle and irritates that ventricular wall. So in this case, we will note that the PA catheter cannot be wedged. It will need to be repositioned by the physician or other qualifying healthcare providers. So following this, we're going to use an X-ray to confirm the catheter placement. So let's talk about the next case here. AJ's PA diastolic and pulmonary capillary wedge pressure are elevated. What does this mean? So remember, our wedge pressure, pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, pulmonary artery wedge pressure is the other one. Measure the same thing. And so what does that tell us? We have fluid overload, probably from heart failure that he has setting in. So simply by looking, we can make guesses as to what's going on. Educated guesses now that you guys are getting so smart. Non-invasive arterial oxygen monitoring. These are ones you have seen before. We've talked about frequently. Pulse ox. So our pulse ox is a non-invasive and continuous method for determining our oxygen saturation on our hemoglobin. We can monitor our SA sat just on the ear or the finger. It can be monitored as well on the forehead. There are devices they can put on the forehead or the earlobe. So make sure we have the proper way to monitor that. Fingernail polish can distort a reading if they have any peripheral vascular disease or they're on blood pressure medications. That can actually affect your O2 sat reading based on the dilation of your vessels. So we have to make sure that the reading we're getting is accurate. Sometimes by looking at someone, you can tell that their O2 sats are low. We need to check their cap refill. That's another thing that would tell us. So we sometimes have to put multiple pieces together to make sure what we're reading is accurate. Our normal sat is 95 to 100%. Some will say 94 to 100%. Again, you get the idea. So the most common use is to measure the effectiveness of the oxygen we're applying. So decrease in our SpO2 indicates inadequate oxygen of the blood and pulmonary capillaries. So we can actually correct this by increasing our FiO2, fraction of inspired oxygen, or by basically turning up their oxygen or putting on an oxygen device. Similarly, using our SpO2 to monitor how the patient tolerates a decrease in oxygen. So if we're trying to wean them off oxygen, we can tell how they're doing as well. So we can use an O2 sat frequently, and you guys have gotten very good with that. There's also something we can do non-invasively, and for non-invasive hemodynamic monitoring, it's called impedance cardiography, or ICG. I'm not going to have you necessarily focus on this one. It's not recommended in patients who have generalized edema or third spacing because the excess volume interferes with accurate signal. So it is just a way of obtaining a cardiac output and assessing your thoracic fluid status, but I'm not going to necessarily have you learn about that one. So I want to end this podcast by just talking about the next slide. Just talking about the nursing management, obtaining baseline observational data. So when we're looking at our patient, that can tell us a whole lot. We don't always need to have an intern monitor placed to tell us how our patient is doing. I mean, critical care, we generally do, but at other times we don't. And even in critical care, we need to look at the other signs to put the full picture together. So when we assess the hemodynamic status of a patient, it requires integration of our data from the many sources that we have and then trending these over time. So thorough basic observation provides important clues about their status. So we begin by obtaining baseline data regarding their general appearance, level of consciousness, skin color and temperature, vital signs, peripheral pulses, cap refill, and urine output. So does the patient look weak, tired, exhausted? There may be too many cardiac reserves to sustain even minimal activity. It tells us a little bit about how the heart's doing. Pale, cool skin, diminished pulses can indicate a decreased cardiac output. Changes in mental status can reflect problems with our cerebral perfusion or oxygenation. Monitoring urine output can determine the adequacy of perfusion to our kidneys. The patient with diminished perfusion to the GI tract may develop hypoactive or even absent bowel sounds. When the body is in distress, it shuts off the blood flow to the non-essential organs, and the gut is one of those. So decreased or absent bowel sounds are something that we could pick up on that would also tell us that there's decreased blood flow to those organs. If the patient is bleeding and developing shock, blood pressure might initially be relatively stable, yet the patient may become increasingly pale and cool or from peripheral vasoconstriction. Conversely, the patient experiencing septic shock may remain warm and pink, yet develop tachycardia and blood pressure instability. Elevated heart rates are common in stressed, compromised, or critically ill patients. However, sustained tachycardia increases myocardial oxygen demand and can result in a decreased cardiac output. So look at all of your pieces to your puzzle and make the best clinical judgment that you can based on all of the data that you have. This is going to end our podcast for podcast one. When we come back, we're going to actually look, start with circulatory assistive devices. So we're going to look at the devices that actually help the blood flow in for podcast number three. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask.